Good evening. By chance, did you look in your bulletin today and notice the title for tonight's sermon? I was wondering, maybe that's why so many people decided not to show up. There it is. It's a five-syllable name. Ahasuerus. What a name. Makes me glad I got a one-syllable name. My name's Joe. That's what my mama called me, unless she was mad at me. So I'm glad for that. But seriously, if you're uncomfortable with the name Ahasuerus, you can just call him Xerxes. The historians do that. The scripture doesn't call him that, but that was his name commonly in history. All kinds of speculation about names like Xerxes and Ahasuerus and Artaxerxes and Darius and other Persian kings, because many of those kings went by more than one name, and there would be more than one king that went by the name Ahasuerus or Xerxes or whatever. I'm going to confine myself this evening to that Ahasuerus that we find in the book of Esther. And you probably figured that out already, so if you haven't already done so, go ahead and turn to the book of Esther. Normally, when we look at this book, we think of Esther, the woman, the queen, the new queen of Persia, because she was a Jew, and she shows us a great example of faith and of courage, undergoing times of trial and danger. And in that sense, of course, she's a great example for us. But tonight, I want to look at Ahasuerus, the king. And you might wonder, well, why would we care about him one way or the other? I mean, he's a pagan, and so he's not even a Jew. But nevertheless, I would submit to you there are at least a couple of reasons why we can benefit from looking, and you already know I like to look at character studies of Bible characters, and particularly those that are not especially well known, and I would classify Ahasuerus as being among those. We sort of know who he is, but mostly we know that he's the guy that appointed Queen Esther as his new queen. But why would we care about this man, Ahasuerus? Number one, yes, he is a pagan, but we should know by experience, if we've been awake for more than about 30 minutes, that both believers and unbelievers do things that are both good and bad. And we can learn from those things and imitate those things that are good, and we can learn to stay away from those things that are not so good. So there's one reason, all by its little self, but perhaps more to the point this evening, I want us to learn to deal constructively with civil rulers who are less than godly. Do we have any of those? One or two or six or 10,000 maybe? Civil rulers who don't do the things that we know they ought to do. And how do we deal with that? Let me just give you an example from 3 weeks ago. 3 weeks ago today was Easter Sunday, right? On that day, the President of the United States made quite an issue of March 31st being Transgender Day of Awareness. I don't know about you, but that rubbed this cat's fur the wrong way. I did not appreciate that. But you know what? I didn't lose a minute of sleep over it. I didn't go out in the street, and neither did you, and protest and fuss and fume, and I didn't sing poor, poor, pitiful me or woe is me or any of that kind of stuff. How do we deal with civil rulers who are less than godly? And by the way, that is not the first time that anybody ever heard of this Transgender Day of Awareness. That began back in 2009. But this was the first time that a president ever made a big deal out of it, and publicly so. And this, by the way, is not a partisan issue. This is not an issue of Republican versus Democrat, liberal versus conservative, or anything else. In the last year of the Donald Trump administration, he recognized the month of June as Gay Pride Month. So if we want to find fault, there's plenty of fault to be found on both sides of the political aisle and everywhere in between. So, again, how do we deal with civil rulers who are less than godly? I want to submit to you that, in a nutshell, we exercise what influence we can. We play the hand that is dealt to us, if you'll let me use an old card playing term. We play the hand that was dealt to us, and that is exactly what Esther did. That is exactly what Mordecai did here in the book of Esther, in their dealings with Ahasuerus. Not everything was just peachy dandy dealing with this pagan king. He did some things that were good. He did some things that you and I would not approve of. What are we going to do about it? Well, obviously, we didn't live back then, so we're not going to really do anything, but what do we think about it? How did God's people that lived back then and experienced those times, how did they deal with this? That's what we want to look at tonight. How do we deal with civil authorities who are less than godly? The first thing we see in chapter 1 here in the book of Esther is in the third year of the reign of Ahasuerus. And this Ahasuerus is identified in chapter 1, verse 1. It says, "This is that Ahasuerus who reigned over 127 provinces from India to Ethiopia." Right? So scripture acknowledges, doesn't it? There's more than one king by the name of Ahasuerus. And the writer says, this is the Ahasuerus that I'm talking about. He is a powerful monarch. Look at the range of his empire. This was an empire. He has all of these provinces, 127 of them, from India to Ethiopia. And we're looking at the third year, chapter 1, verse 3, of his reign. Some historians think that the third year of his reign was immediately after he had subjugated Egypt. He had successfully brought Egypt under his control, and so he's having all these high officials in his kingdom. There in verse 3 it says, "In the third year of his reign he made a feast for all his officials and servants, the powers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of the province being before him." Well, why would he do that? Is he just kicking up his heels, having a good time? Probably not. He's got better things to do than that. The historians speculate, and probably with some reason, that he is showing all of these officials from all over his empire, "Here's the fabulous wealth that I have that will enable me to make war on Greece," which he did. Spoiler alert, it didn't work out very well. But evidently he did go to war against Greece, and he may well be showing his officials in his kingdom, "I've got the money to do this." That would make a lot of sense. So the gathering with these officials lasted, this passage tells us here in chapter 1, for 6 months. He spends 6 months getting all these people convinced that, look at all the wealth that I have, look at all the splendor, everything that I have at my disposal. And then after that, he makes a feast, not only for the officials of his kingdom, but for everyone in the capital city of Shushan, or Susa, as it's more commonly known. And he supplies everything for a feast for 7 days. And you see there the opulent furnishings. Verse 6, "There were white and blue linen curtains fastened with cords of fine linen and purple on silver rods and marble pillars and the couches were gold and silver, and a mosaic pavement of alabaster and turquoise and white and black marble, and on it goes, talking all these wonderful things, this opulent riches that he has at his disposal. And he's serving wine from golden vessels, and every one of them is different. Every one of them is unique. None of this mass-produced stuff. The goldsmiths have made every one of these different, and he's serving drinks in these golden vessels. And I appreciate the fact that the text tells us that drinking was not mandatory. It was optional. He didn't say you've got to get bombed out of your head, though probably a lot of them were doing that. They could drink as much or as little as they pleased. So give him a little bit of credit for that. And it says there that it was according to the law. That does not mean the law of Moses. Persian king didn't care one thing about the law of Moses. He's talking about Persian law. And so we would give this pagan king and his law a little bit of credit that at least he's not forcing people to do untoward things. Queen Vashti also makes a feast for the women. Now, the specifics of that we could speculate on all day long. Were they getting bombed as well? I don't know. Doesn't really matter. But the fact of it is, she was making, was permitted and maybe even required to make a feast for the women, as well as the king doing this for all the men. Well, all of this drinking, you can pretty well imagine what's going on here. They're drinking for 7 solid days and eating all of this rich food. And so they're going to be less than sober, if we can put it gently. They're not going to be entirely in control of themselves. In verse 10 of chapter 1, on the 7th day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine. Okay, what does he do? He commands Mahuman, Biztha, man, I'm glad my name is Joe, Harbona, Bigtha, Abagtha, Zethkar, and Caracas, the 7 eunuchs who served in the presence of Ahasuerus, to bring Queen Vashti before the king, wearing her royal crown, in order to show her beauty to the people and the officials, for she was beautiful to behold. So the king basically demands, bring the queen in all of her royal beauty, and let's parade her beauty before this bunch of drunken men. You like that? I don't like that. I would think even a pagan king, if he wasn't drunk, would know better and would want to guard the purity and the chastity and the modesty of his queen better than this. Maybe that's just me, but that just seems to me that a king would want to do that. She was beautiful to behold, verse 11. And that's to be expected. The Persian king, a pagan king, is not going to select someone who isn't drop-dead gorgeous to be his wife, to be his queen. And so he wants everybody, all these men that he has invited, and they're for the most part intoxicated, and he wants them to see the beauty of his king, of his queen, rather. I would hope that he would be more considerate and respectful of her when he's sober. But the long and short of it is, he becomes furious when Vashti refuses to come. Verse 12, Vashti refused to come at the king's command brought by his eunuchs. Therefore, the king was furious and his anger burned within him. I'm saying, you go, girl. You don't need to display your beauty before this bunch of drunks. You deserve more dignity than that. Well, the king didn't see it that way. He is accustomed to having absolute authority. The king was viewed one of two ways, either as a god, which is probably more accurate with this man, or at least as a God in the making. When he dies, he'll become a God. But the thing is, he is supposed to have absolute authority. When the king says, frog, you better jump. If he says, jump, your only question is, how high? You don't question whether you do it or whether you don't. Well, Vashti didn't come at his command. And so, in the 13th verse, the king says to the wise men who understood the times, for this was the king's manner toward all who knew law and justice, those closest to him, and he names several of them there, who had access to the king's presence and had highest rank in the kingdom, what shall we do to Queen Vashti according to the law because she did not obey the command of King Ahasuerus brought to her by the eunuchs? He relies on his advisors, whom he says knew the law. Again, they are experts in Persian law. And he says they understood the times. What do you suppose that's talking about? We're talking about astrology here. They knew the times. They knew the seasons and the zodiac and all of this stuff. And they wouldn't want to do anything if the zodiac signs were not favorable. Now, astrology is just another pagan religion. Bank on that. If you're reading your horoscope and going by that, repent. Do so quickly, because it is simple paganism. That's all it is. Nevertheless, he wants to know what would be the appropriate thing to do with Vashti, because she has not come at my command. Now, his advisors in verses 17 and 18 were especially concerned that all the women in the empire would hear what the queen had done, and they're going to say to their husbands, we ain't doing what you say. Pardon the butchery of the king's English there. We will feel free to be disobedient to you. We will despise you. Just as they would say that the queen had despised King Ahasuerus. And so they give their opinion then. A royal decree should be made, chapter 1, verse 19, that Vashti be deposed from being the queen. And she could never again come before the king. Now, some interpret that to mean she would be divorced. That's not necessarily the case. It could be that she would simply be banished to the harem room, the place where the king's harem was kept. He had lots of wives. And she would never again be called to the king's presence. And this would be, by the way, an unalterable law. You've heard of the law of Medes and Persians? Cannot be changed, right? Why? If you make a dumb law, why can't you make a law that says, no, we're not going to do this? I mean, we do that in our country. If we don't like a law that's been made, we say, okay, here's another law that says law such and such is null and void. If you're a god, you don't do that. Here's the thing. The Persian king was a god, small g. Gods don't make mistakes. And so if you change the law, you're in essence saying, I made a mistake. You can't do that if you're a small g, not even if you're a small g god. And that's what the king would consider himself to be. So this would be an unalterable law. Ahasuerus followed the recommendation of his advisors. And thus, when we get to chapter 2, we see the need for a new queen. Okay, we've gotten rid of Vashti. Now what are we going to do? We can't have a king without a queen. And so we're going to have to make a new queen somehow or another. Now, there's a considerable time lapse between the deposing of Vashti and the making of Esther as the new queen. In chapter 1, we're in the third year of his reign. Esther is crowned in the seventh year of his reign. Look at chapter 2, verse 16. Some, again, think that this is when the war against Greece occurred. And as we mentioned before, it did not go well. One full year of preparation was required after Esther and all of the other girls were taken into the harem, basically, and they were given all of these preparations to make them ready to have an interview before the king. Who knows how long it took to gather all of those girls together, all of those virgins, and who knows how many of them came before the king, before Esther herself was called. Those are all speculative questions that we can't really give a hard and fast answer to. But we might wonder, well, why didn't he just select a new queen from among the wives, the many, many wives that he already had? The concubines, the ones in the harem. Why didn't he just select a new one from among those? Well, here's the thing. Oriental kings, and I don't mean Chinese, Japanese here, I mean kings in the East, viewed a large harem as a symbol of status and strength. Remember a man by the name of Solomon? 700 wives. Is that man out of his mind or what? 300 concubines. That was considered in that culture a sign of dignity and a sign of strength and status. In fact, we're going to see in chapter 2, verse 19, even after Esther is made the new queen, there is another gathering of young virgins to be taken into the king's harem. And again, you and I might look at that and say, that's just wrong. And we'd be right about that. Expect pagans to act like pagans. If there's one lesson we can learn tonight, I think that will be it. Expect pagans to act like pagans. Don't expect unbelievers to behave like believers. That's unreasonable. It's called the world for a reason. There's a difference between the world and the people of God. So expect pagans to behave like pagans. If you'll notice, as Esther is being prepared and all of the other virgins are being prepared for their interview with the king, there is a heavy emphasis on physical beauty. She's given all of these preparations, all of this stuff. And we guys aren't all that familiar with things like that. Probably the ladies here are a little more familiar. You know, they know what makeup is and mascara and eyeliner and all the rest of this stuff. We guys aren't into that. But that was very, very important for this pagan king. He wanted his wives, plural, to be absolutely as beautiful as they could possibly be. There's a heavy emphasis on physical beauty. And again, do we approve of that kind of emphasis? Obviously, Scripture does not. 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 3 and 4, Peter specifically says, don't make your goal physical beauty. Let it be the inner person, the meek and quiet spirit that is of great price in the sight of God. Let that be your adornment. But once again, expect pagans to act like pagans. When the pagan king wants a beautiful wife, that's what he's going after. Physical beauty is going to be his chief goal. So don't blame Esther for this. Please don't think ill of Esther. She doesn't have a say in this. She didn't ask to be brought into this. Don't even know if she was all that wild about it when somebody tapped her on the shoulder and said, by the way, you're going in here to be readied for an interview with the king, and it's going to take a solid year for you to get ready. She may not have liked that at all, but the point is she had no choice in the matter. So please don't hold it against her. Now, in the meantime, she is appointed as the queen, and in chapter 3, we see something more about Ahasuerus. And that is that he promotes one of his servants, not sermons, a servant by the name of Haman. And of course, if you know the book of Esther, you know what the deal's going to be with Haman. He is bad news. He is clearly full of himself, and the king doesn't really help that very much, because he gives a decree, he elevates this man to a very high position in the kingdom, and he makes everyone bow down and pay homage to this servant of his. Now, the expression that's used here in the book of Esther about bowing down and paying homage, both of those expressions can be used of religious worship, that which should be given only to God. Sometimes, however, that those same expressions are used of respect for lesser people, people that are not God. The size of it is, Mordecai looks at this, Esther's uncle looks at this as religious worship, and he says, not going to do it. I'm not going to bow before this servant of the king, this official. So it seems to me that Ahasuerus is placing way too much trust in this man, because Haman, we know, gets all upset. What am I going to do with this stubborn Jew who will not bow down to me? I know what I'm going to do. I'm not only going to get rid of him, I'm going to get rid of all his people. The whole Jewish population. We're just going to kill them all. And he goes to the king and says, there's this obnoxious bunch of people in your kingdom, and they're not good for you. We need to just kill them. And Ahasuerus says, okay, sure. Let's make a decree. We'll kill them all. He places way too much confidence in this man. He acts entirely upon the recommendation of Haman. That's in chapter 3, from the 9th verse on. But even though we don't like what he did there, we don't approve of that. We think that's over the top. Give Ahasuerus credit. He did what he could to correct his mistakes. He had made a mistake earlier. If we go to chapter 6, the first 3 verses or thereabouts, the king can't sleep one night. He has some people reading from the archives. Here's various things that happened. Lo and behold, here's this fellow by the name of Mordecai, who has basically saved the king's bacon. Here's some people that are threatening the life of the king. They want to kill him. Mordecai hears about it, reports it, and these fellows get executed, and the king's life is saved. He says, well, what have we done for Mordecai? Not a thing. Well, that was a mistake. That doesn't show much gratitude. So he says, okay, I want to do something nice for him. In comes Haman. What shall we do for the one whom the king delights to honor? Haman's thinking, he's so full of himself. Surely it is me. I am the one whom the king delights to honor. So he says, well, have the one whom you delight to honor ride on your royal steed, and we'll clothe him in purple and put gold around his neck and have everybody bow before him, and everything will be wonderful. King says, okay, go do that for Mordecai. Get on your way. If you're Haman, what are you thinking? Oh, man, I am in trouble. Something is haywire here. I thought it was me for sure, and it's not. It's this guy that I hate. Oh, and not only that, I've already got the plans in the works to kill him and all of his people. I've got this gallows prepared. I'm going to hang him on it. And by the way, a gallows there does not mean put a rope around somebody's neck and a short drop and a sudden stop and they're dead. Nope. They would be impaled on a pole. Horrible way to die. Or at best, They would be put to death and their body displayed on a pole. But more than likely, they would be put there alive and they would stay there until they died. Very, very inhumane and very difficult way to die. So, Esther knows now, she is notified of this plot that Haman has to destroy all of the Jews. We love Esther because she very bravely goes to the king in spite of the fact that it's been a month since he has summoned her. The king is evidently very, very busy. He's got things to do, things on his mind. And the law of the Medes and Persians, remember what that was? If you presume to just go to the king and he doesn't wish to see you, guess what happens to you? You're dead, just like that. Esther, what are you going to do? Mordecai says to her, don't think for a minute that you're going to escape. If Haman goes through with this plan, you'll be dead right along with the rest of us. And who knows the famous line, who knows but what you've come to the kingdom for such a time as this? So Esther says, okay, pray for me, fast for me, I'm going to the king. And she does. And I have to love Ahasuerus because what does he do? He extends the royal scepter when she appears. He evidently, truly loves her. And he doesn't want any harm to come to her. In fact, he says, I'll give you anything. Tell me what you want, and I'll give you anything up to half the kingdom. Now, maybe that's just a figure of speech, but he's saying, I really care about what you need. And I'll do my utmost to satisfy whatever needs that you have. And so, of course, we know how that goes, that she makes a feast for him and for Haman and says, I'm going to do another one tomorrow, and then I'll tell you what I want. And in the second feast, of course, she lowers the boom, doesn't she? She says, my people and I are in danger. We're going to be killed. And right there's the guy who's responsible, this wicked Haman. The king is livid. He is so angry, he leaves the room. Poor stupid Haman falls on Queen Esther, trying to get out of this mess, and the king comes back in. Oh, you would even assault the queen. Of course, that wasn't exactly what Haman was trying to do, but it sure didn't look good. So where does Haman end up? On the very gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Ahasuerus did his best to correct his mistakes. Give him credit for that. Swift justice on Haman. Then, what did we say about the law of Medes and Persians? It can't be changed. We can't say we're going to nullify this law that all the Jews are going to be put to death. What are we going to do? We'll make another law that says the Jews can arm themselves and they can fight and they can protect themselves, and they do. And when that day comes that they're all to be put to death, there's a whole herd of the enemy that gets put to death instead. And so, once again, he is doing his best to correct his mistakes. He recognizes that this law to murder all the Jews is not good. He can't change it, but he can add to it and give the Jews the right to defend themselves, and they do so very effectively. And at the end of the day, he actually promotes Mordecai rather than Haman. Now it's Mordecai who is basically second in command, a whole lot like Joseph in Egypt. He has the king's signet, and he has all kinds of authority. So, what's the bottom line here? Once again, expect pagans to act like pagans. Don't expect the world to act like the church. Not going to happen. There is no point in getting all upset and saying, oh, woe is us, Our country's gone to the dogs. Whatever are we going to do? You do the best you can. You have whatever influence you can, and you play the hand that is dealt to you. That's the best advice that I can give. I believe that is consistent with Holy Scripture and consistent with the will of God. So tonight, if there are those in our assembly who are subject to the Lord's invitation, the song of invitation has been announced, and we'll stand together and sing that song to encourage your response.